Today's episode is presented by Equinor. Evolving into a broad energy company, harvesting power from the strong winds out at sea is one of our solutions for the European energy transition.
The best news in terms of dealing with this COVID pandemic is the announcement by Pfizer and BioNTech that their vaccine protects against 90% of cases. That's the best news, I would say, after the election of Joe Biden for the United States.
Welcome to EU Confidential, the number one European politics podcast. I'm Andrew Gray, Politico's EU editor in Brussels. And you just heard the voice of Peter Piot, the renowned Belgian virus expert, who's now advising the European Commission president on COVID-19. He's our special guest on the podcast this week, and I really recommend sticking around for a fascinating interview. As you heard there, Piot breaks down the big news of the week, the prospect of a highly effective vaccine being available soon. He also talks more generally about what we know about the coronavirus that we didn't know at the start, how we can better fight it, and how we need to prepare for more pandemics. In fact, it's been quite the week for news since we last spoke. As Piot mentioned, we also have a declared winner of the US presidential election. And we had a deal in Brussels that brings the new EU budget and coronavirus recovery fund a step closer. So let's dive into all of that, starting with our podcast panel. So it's welcome back to Reem Momtaz in Paris. Hi, Reem.
Hello, hello.
Did you have a good week off?
I really did. Really needed
good.
It.
Good. Well, it was very quiet. Nothing much happened, so you didn't miss anything.
I'm sorry to have left you in a lurch like that.
No, not at all. We had plenty of people happy to jump in, but good to have you back. Lily Beyer is with us again from our Brussels politics team. Hi, Lily.
Hi, everyone.
And Matt Karnichnik joins us, our chief Europe correspondent based in Berlin. Hi, Matt.
Hello.
So we talked in a special edition of the podcast last week about the US presidential election. We kind of thought we knew the way it was heading, and that turned out to be the case. But the winner had not been declared at that point. There had been no official reaction to the result itself from European leaders at that point. So European leaders have been coming out. Some of them have now spoken to Joe Biden. Reem, let's start with you because we didn't have you last week. What, if you could sum up the French reaction, what's been their response both to Joe Biden's victory and to the way that Donald Trump is dealing with it or not dealing with it?
You know, it's interesting because it's actually not straightforward in France. There's definitely a sigh of relief in the sense that Élysée officials tell us they're very keen to see the United States of America come back into the multilateral agencies. On the other hand, you know, there are two perhaps points on which there's a bit of trepidation. One, there's trepidation on sort of the current completely unprecedented situation that they're having to deal with, which is current US President Trump not having conceded yet. And, you know, it's hard for foreign leaders to have to navigate that and to manage that for the next few months, really the next couple of months. And there's also, you know, they're cautiously optimistic about a Biden administration, but they're not also sort of jumping for joy and saying, oh, you know, thank God we're like back to normal. And it's something that Macron has actually been saying pretty consistently for the past few years, that no matter who is president in the US is no longer, will no longer be as engaged as they used to be. And that's why the Europeans need to really take on board his ideas of strategic autonomy. And they're still on that line.
Matt, Angela Merkel spoke to Joe Biden and also had quite an interesting statement. She actually came out and gave a statement on the US reaction, which was notable for what she did say and what she didn't say. I imagine she's pretty pleased, right?
Yes. I mean, she didn't mention the elephant in the room, Donald Trump, with whom she's had a very difficult relationship, obviously. And that was in itself significant. I don't believe the two have talked in months and may never speak again. So there was no love lost there. I did think it was interesting, though, that she decided to make a special announcement in the way that she did. And though she does sort of speak fairly frequently to the press, it's often at these kind of protocol situations where you have a visiting leader, or it's on a very specific subject where she'll take questions from the press, be it COVID or something else. And in this case, she didn't take any questions. She gave the statement and she said all of the right things you know, I think from an American perspective about the transatlantic relationship and how important it had been to Germany and so forth. But it felt a little bit to me like she was speaking about the old relationship, and that relationship doesn't really exist anymore in that form. And since she's going to be leaving soon herself, I think that there's still a lot of question marks about where the transatlantic relationship, in particular the U.S.-German relationship, is going to go under President Biden and beyond.
So, Lily, let's talk a bit about the Central and Eastern European reaction. We talked about that again last week, once again before the, you know, the result had been officially, or officially, of course, is a controversial word these days, but before the world, before the result had been generally accepted and declared. But now that, you know, the world in general, with some exceptions, has congratulated Joe Biden, accepted his victory, how are they dealing with that? What's their messaging? Have they outright congratulated him?
Yes. So the Polish and Hungarian governments have both sent messages of congratulations to Joe Biden. But there are a few layers here. So while officially, for example, Viktor Orban has sent a letter to Biden, unofficially in the pro-government Hungarian media, we're still seeing a certain promotion of questioning of the results in the US. So I do see some signaling to Orban's core voters that we're still on the Trump side. We still see Trump's perspective. But I think that officially there is a recognition that Biden has won and that they need to build some sort of relationship with the future White House. What we've seen from Slovenia has been incredibly interesting. So Prime Minister Janez Janša there has been retweeting conspiracy theories, questioning the outcome of the election. He's the only prime minister, I believe, who has not congratulated or formally accepted the result of the election. And that really sets him apart from the leaderships in Poland and Hungary.
Right. And we've seen the Slovenians trying to do, or other Slovenians trying to do, what they would regard as damage control. The president of Slovenia, the European commissioner from Slovenia, both very publicly congratulating Biden and obviously quite concerned about how their standing will be with the new administration. I noticed the phrasing, at least initially from, you know, top Polish and Hungarian leaders, was also quite neat in that it congratulated Biden on his successful presidential campaign, but didn't quite actually congratulate him on winning the presidency. So I there does appear to be some very careful phrasing going on at the moment. Let's leave the US presidential election for a moment, because I'm sure we'll be talking about it plenty in the months ahead, and focus on something that happened here in Brussels this week. Big news, Lily, bring us up to date. The EU budget and recovery fund have been kind of on hold to an extent since the big agreement in July among EU leaders, but we've finally had a breakthrough of sorts this week, right? So what happened and what happens next?
Right. So I think perhaps some listeners may not realize that when the July big deal was sealed after 4 days and four nights of really difficult talks, that was not the end of the road, because the bloc's long-term budget still needs to be signed off by the European Parliament, and then it needs a final green light from the Council. So what has been happening since late August is that the Parliament and the Council have been in negotiations, because members of parliament really wanted to show that they also have a say in this deal and that they have influenced the outcome. So they were pushing for more money, especially for programs in areas such as health and research. They finally did get a bit of extra money, 15 billion, which in the grand scheme of things is not a lot, but they're quite happy with it. It'll go mostly toward the Horizon Europe Research Program, toward the health program, and a few other things like education. But we are still not at the end. So the deal caused a lot of relief across the bloc. I was speaking to Budget Commissioner Johannes Hahn yesterday. He said that officials at the commission were incredibly relieved as well that this political deal is done. But the European Parliament still needs to vote. The Council still needs to sign off. And there's still the matter of the 750 billion coronavirus recovery fund, which is a lot more complicated, because in order to borrow money for that fund, not only does the council need to sign off, but national parliaments need to sign off as well. And this is very tricky. And while we wait, the commission cannot borrow money for the recovery fund, which a lot of countries, especially in the South, have really been waiting for.
Sounds a little bit like the American election.
Yeah, it's never the never-ending story.
Never. Yes,
just when you think you've... Yeah. But in this case, Lily, also you have the issue of, to bring it back to Viktor Orban again, the possibility that due to his objections to a separate measure, which is meant to link payouts from the EU budget to respect for the rule of law and allow a mechanism for those payouts to be stopped if the EU determines that the rule of law is not being upheld. So it is a separate measure, but he is threatening to block the budget if he's not happy with that measure, right? So, I mean, I know it's impossible to say definitively, but how's that going to play out, or how might that play out?
Yeah, so this is the big guessing game in Brussels at the moment. Is Viktor Orban bluffing when he threatens to block both the long-term budget and the recovery fund? For context, this is 1.8 trillion euros worth of money, and any government can block the whole thing. So it's a very powerful sort of weapon. But I think from talking to officials, there's a lot of skepticism that he would go that far, in large part because Hungary itself would really, really benefit from this cash.
Right. And it would also put him in the position right across Europe of being the guy who's holding up badly needed recovery funds at the time when, you know, the continent is in a deep recession. So that would be a bold move, certainly, to go that far. Okay, well, lots for us to keep track of in the weeks and months ahead. We'll leave it there for now. Reem, Lily, Matt, we'll be back at the end briefly with your recommendations for things to keep our listeners engaged and entertained. But for now, thanks very much. And in just 1 minute, we'll bring you that interview with Peter Piot on the coronavirus.
A message from Equinor. Offshore wind farms harvesting power from the strong winds out at sea are one of our solutions for Europe's energy transition. Our offshore wind farms in Europe already generate enough electricity to power the equivalent of 1 million homes. And we have developed the world's first floating wind farm, enabling the harvest of the winds in deeper waters. Now we are developing the world's largest offshore wind farm, Dogger Bank in the UK North Sea. It alone can power 4.5 million homes. Offshore wind projects are getting bigger, and they are getting more complex. We in Equinor see a sea of opportunities off the coast of Europe to support the energy transition and an industrial renewal.
Now let's get to our interview with Peter Piot. In many ways, he's the perfect guest to talk about the coronavirus. He's been working on viruses for decades. He co-discovered Ebola in the 1970s and later worked extensively on HIV/AIDS, including as boss of the UN programme UNAIDS. He's director of the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine and now also an advisor on COVID-19 to Ursula von der Leyen, the European Commission President. Piot also brings very personal experience to that role. He contracted the disease in early March, and he talked in the interview about how that changed his view on the virus. But first, we dove into the big news of the week.
Well, the best news in terms of dealing with this COVID pandemic is the announcement by Pfizer and BioNTech, a German company, that their vaccine protects against 90% of cases for developing a symptomatic disease, illness. And that's the best news, I would say, after the election of Joe Biden for the United States, where I hope now that there will be some serious action taken by the federal government. And this vaccine is hopefully, you know, the first of a series that will show efficacy. Personally, I thought it would rather be more on around 60%. Of protection. So that's really beyond my expectations. And if several other vaccines are going to be in the same range, then we can really start thinking about going back to normal. However, there's still a few things that have to happen. One, these are preliminary results, so they have to be confirmed. And I have no doubt that that will be confirmed. What's equally important, there were no side effects that were notable, you know, that's very important. But we need to know How long will this protection last? Will we need an annual injection or not? Will it work with older people? You know, that's another question. People like, in my case, where we had already an infection before, will it also protect us? And then in the case of the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine, is the logistic issues. It has to be preserved at minus 80 degrees. So that's dry ice. That's really very cold. In contrast to the regular vaccines that are being used, that's fridge temperature. But, you know, logistic issues can be overcome. What's key now is that we follow the route for, approval of these vaccines, that there's good scrutiny, and then that manufacturing is boosted. It seems that Pfizer can deliver already tens of millions of doses within the next few months, as soon as there is an emergency authorization, but also that countries are getting ready. And that should be one of the priorities for the European Union, for each member state, that, you know, this is a huge logistic operation. And when you judge by the fiasco of test and trace in many countries, in many member states, that means that we really need to make an extra effort. This is nothing medical. This is about, you know, mobilizing people. You can't do it just with doctors and nurses, but there will be other people that will have to be trained, and that's pretty easy. The logistics, the supply chain, transport, the data management, just name it. And so we better all do some fire drills and test the systems right now.
Now, let me ask you a couple of kind of real layman's questions. You mentioned that even if this news is as good as it appears, it would still be good to have other vaccines. Why is it important not just to have this one? Why can't we just kind of roll this one out across the world and be happy with that?
No, I wouldn't mind if it's just one vaccine, but I think it's always safer to have several options because, again, we are at very early phase and it could be that vaccine A works better with older people, or vaccine B protects for 2 years or 10 years, or is easy to transport or cheaper. All these elements are there. And it could also be that we have a first generation and then maybe a next generation. In general, the rule is that the first ones are not, you know, as good as often the second, you know, generation of vaccines or drugs. But you have to start. The first ones are really, really important. And for example, to make international travel possible. But before you see an impact at the population level, that's going to take time. And we will have to continue to respect some safety measures, wearing masks, some distancing. And in addition, I think we will soon have probably nothing but a small revolution in terms of testing, where we could have rapid, simple tests that in 5 or 10 minutes can tell you I'm infected or not. So which would, you can imagine that at the entrance of a football stadium or before boarding a plane or go to the opera or whatever you want to do, that people can be tested. So technologies and science are really going to help us to get out of this nightmare.
Mm. You mentioned, you know, what you called the fiasco of test and trace in a lot of countries, and also that kind of missed opportunity, you know, when the prevalence of the virus at least appeared to have receded. How do you explain that? How do you explain why that happened?
Well, first of all, I think that nobody has ever been confronted with a pandemic of this scale in modern history. The last time on a massive scale was the Spanish flu, and then we didn't even have tests. We didn't even know what the virus was. That's one thing. Secondly, there are countries that have done it well. In Europe, when you look at Germany, very early on, they developed a test. They distributed it. It was done in a very decentralized way because also of the federal system. It, you know, a very aggressive testing and people had access to it, and that worked for quite a while. Certainly also in East Asia, Southeast Asia, good examples. But when you look at the UK, for example, their very centralist approach, that clearly didn't work. And this is about logistics, coordination, communication, something that you know, you have to put in charge people who know that. That's not necessarily the strength of, let's say, neither the medical profession or the public health profession. And I think also probably a bit of complacency during the summer. We were all very happy to come out of the lockdowns and the figures went down. And, you know, was not appreciated what it could do. Even if, and here in defense of the European Commission, on the 15th of July, the Commission issued a statement encouraging member states to get ready for the, you know, when the winter comes, to invest in testing and trace. I mean, it was, I reread it recently, and, you know, it could have been released yesterday because it's all there, but it was not followed. And understandably also, because summer is tourism season, as people were kind of fed up with the lockdown, they wanted to go away. But we really wasted time, that's for sure.
Mm. That kind of brings me to a question which I wondered about. Obviously, one of your roles now is as advisor to the European Commission President, Ursula von der Leyen. And I just wonder if, in a sense, you're advising the right person if the Commission can't really do much, or what more can be done at European level? Or is this ultimately something for national governments? Would your advice be better directed towards, you know, individual national governments and national leaders?
Well, it's true that health is not a competency of the European Union, in contrast to, let's say, trade. I mean, health is not in there. And for understandable reasons, and I think it's, you know, because the healthcare systems are so specific to country. And so that's the issue. But on the other hand, viruses don't know borders. There are, you know, in Europe where we're so integrated, not only economically, but also the personal level, and with densely populated, that it's important to have, to say the least, some well-coordinated action. So what the Commission has done is where it does have competency, and that I think is really, I would say, pretty historic, is this procurement, at, you know, agreements with vaccine producers. And to make sure that every single member state, also the smaller ones, the poorer ones, will have access, equal access to whatever vaccine will come on the market. And these are still being negotiated. Three are being concluded and some others are now being discussed. But that, I think, is really very important, because there was a time that four countries, was the Netherlands, Germany, France and Italy, were doing their own negotiations. And, you know, I can understand from their perspective. But on the other hand, you know, we felt from, you know, the Commission side that if that's the case, it means that other countries will really not benefit from it, and particularly the ones with less negotiating power. Also ensuring green corridors, in other words, that transport of goods could continue during lockdown and during the fact when borders were in control, and also procurement, you know, in the spring, of protective gear and so on, because some countries was a shortage. That's another big difference with spring. Today, there are enough face masks, there are enough respirators, oxygen and so on in Europe. And now also procurement for tests. I'm also concerned about what's going on in what's called in the official jargon, the periphery, the Western Balkans. Ukraine has a really bad epidemic, Moldova. There is so much interaction that that's where there is a responsibility. But I hope that this will be a lesson for all of us, that when it comes to epidemics and pandemics, you need strong international cooperation. And my understanding is that today there is far more appetite for doing that, for working together, than in the spring peak. We need to be prepared now for the next pandemic already, and so taking the lessons.
Mm, that's what I wondered. I've seen that you've spoken before that we're almost in an era of pandemics now, or could be. Do we need to kind of adjust ourselves to the coronavirus not being the last of these, that we're going to have more of these in the years ahead? And how do we kind of change the way society works to be able to deal with that?
Yeah, everything points to the fact that we will have more pandemics. And why is that? It is really a synergies, I would say, of increasing population density and population pressure on nature, urbanization, you know, because again, let's not forget that these viruses come from other animals. So we need to think not only about following what's going on in people, but also in wild animals, in livestock, the wildlife trade, illegal in many cases, climate change, which will also increase the risk for mosquito-transmitted epidemics. So it's actually, to make a very big statement, but our inability to live in harmony with nature. And then we have the mobility. What used to be a local outbreak, you know, let's say 100 years ago, if an outbreak in Wuhan may have reached us at the end of the day, but not in a few weeks' time. All this makes that we need to be much better prepared, and we've got the means to do that. But it means that there is a need for developing that infrastructure. And that's where leadership is also important, because you need to take decisions before you really have a big problem, before people dying and all. And it's not that it's a choice between public health or the economy. Some analysis showed that the countries that have done worst in terms of dealing with this epidemic and have the highest mortality have also had the highest loss in GDP. In other words, in economic loss. So it's a false dichotomy. If we don't bring this epidemic under control, forget about the economy. It's as simple as that. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't think carefully whenever measures that we put in place, that we always should look at the economic fallout. And also, you know, this is going to push people into poverty. Epidemics often exacerbate inequalities in society. And that's what's happening also now. So this leadership is part, I think, is really key, and have the ability to analyze and to act quickly.
Yeah. Let me ask you one final question, actually, before you go. How did actually having the virus yourself, how did that kind of change your understanding of it? Did it make any difference?
Yeah, it was having had the disease, not just the infection myself, I would say makes it not only personal, but also better understanding what it can mean to people. Because the official communication, certainly in these days in the spring, was we have to flatten the curve, we have to reduce the reproductive rate. It was pretty to the ridiculous nearly that prime ministers were giving lectures on the reproductive rate of a virus. We have to protect the health services or the NHS in the UK. And it was never about people. And sometimes as an afterthought, you know, saving lives. So, and that, I got really angry about that. But also the idea was that most people have either nothing or a bit of the flu. And then a few, then they die. And anyway, they're very old and they have underlying conditions. And so I'm old, I'm 71, but I didn't have any underlying conditions, you know. And it took me about 5 months to get really over it, because with exhaustion, I had heart problems. I mean, this virus invades every single cell of your body. And I suspect there will be worldwide millions of people suffering for quite several months. So I wanted to highlight that. And that's a better understanding. And that includes also young people, by the way, because young people, indeed, statistically, the risk of dying is much, much lower. No doubt about it. But that doesn't mean it's a zero. And what we are now learning is that even young people who have a mild infection, mild disease, can have this months and months lingering infection with being very tired, not being able to work, and so on. And that, I think, is still not very well known. And so, and I think they should just tell the story, I think, because one of the concerns I have is that COVID fatigue. It's very different when you say, okay, we have lockdown for 6 weeks or 2 weeks or 3 weeks, and then it's over. But now, again, and it's dark, it's not summer, and there is, you know, it could go on for months. So we need to think through about communication also for those in power and policymakers, and make it a bit more about people and not only about statistics. And then, of course, there is now hope with a vaccine.
That was Peter Piot talking to me earlier this week. And now Reem, Matt and Lily are back with some recommendations, lockdown recommendations to help get us through this difficult time when we're spending so much time at home, things to listen to or read or watch. Matt, what have you got? What's your recommendation?
It's called Fauda, and it's an Israeli series about a counter-terrorism unit that infiltrates Hamas, and it's very good. I can see Reem is already excited about this pick.
Reem is tearing her hair out, but okay.
Several seasons of this show, and I recommend watching it in the original Hebrew. There's subtitles, so anyway, it gives it a much more feel of authenticity.
Okay, Reem, I think, is probably giving that the thumbs down. So you can choose. The great thing about this format is you can choose whose recommendations to follow and whose you might not want to follow. Reem, what's yours this week?
I'm taking a break from war and politics and all that is related to work. And I am going to recommend the one, the only, Bruce Springsteen in conversation with NPR. You should go find it. It's Bruce Springsteen Talks Loss and Hope in Letter to You, because it's his
new... Is this
new...
the one with Steve Inskeep, the interview with Steve Inskeep? Yeah, I've heard that
one. And it's his new album, and it's really worth it, and it just is a balm to the heart. So go for it.
I have to say, I was thinking of recommending the Springsteen album. I'm a Springsteen fan, I would say. I would say that this album, he almost sounds like a Bruce Springsteen tribute act. You know, I mean, there is nothing sort of fresh or new about this, but in some ways, that's kind of exactly what you need. You know, you just need Bruce Springsteen blasting out at high volume. I think there's something to be said for it. Lily.
So one thing I've been doing during the lockdown is I have a goal, which is to read all of Thomas Mann's novels.
Wow.
I felt like this is the time, the lockdowns, to actually get that off my list.
Okay, and thank you for raising the tone. And how are you doing? Is there one in particular that you'd recommend for us?
So during the first lockdown, I finished Buddenbrooks, which I really loved. And yeah, so I'm getting through some of the other ones now. It's a bit of a slow process. They're very thick, but it's very rewarding.
Okay, and a final recommendation for me would be, it's a kind of boring one. It's a bit of a must read. Many of our listeners will have read it already, but it is a piece that Joe Biden wrote, I suspect with a bit of help from his team, for Foreign Affairs earlier this year. It was published in April, Why America Must Lead Again. It basically sets out his foreign policy agenda, and I think obviously that's going to be important reading for a lot of people as they try to get up to speed with what this new administration is planning in terms of foreign policy. So Reem, Matt and Lily, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And that's all the time we have on this episode of EU Confidential. If you haven't yet subscribed to the podcast, we encourage you to stop right now, take a moment and click subscribe or follow on whatever platform you use to listen to us. That will make sure you never miss an episode. And you can always send us feedback or ideas for future shows. The email address is podcast@politico.eu. We read every email and we try to reply to all of them as well, even if it takes us a little while sometimes. Until next week, I'm Andrew Gray in Brussels. Thanks to our producer, Christina Gonzalez, and thanks to you for listening.